It gives me really a tremendous pleasure to introduce our next speaker. The term bat mitzvah, ironically, that Rabbi Reichman mentioned, was first mentioned when Rabbi Steinberg was at our conference last year. And Baruch Hashem, he has been a speaker without fail every year from its inception, and thought about the bat mitzvah year. As we will see later today, we will have some sort of a recognition of the bat mitzvah year. We had different plans, but God obviously changed that around, and now we are discussing the coronavirus in more detail. One of the questions that came up, and of course not being competitive, was what is the longest running Jewish medical ethics conferences in the world? There was some machlokas exactly how many years it was, whether it was at 12 or 13, and whether it was consecutive or not. And the question, of course, halachically is, does this year count or not? So I'd like to suggest, based on Rav Soloveitchik's understanding of the continuity, if a person forgets the count at night, but he remembers in the day, he can continue to count with a bracha the next night. So long as the continuity continues in any form and there's a sort of a memory, then you can continue to count. So I'd like to suggest that we are still able to count not only that this is the 12th year, but it's the 12th consecutive year. And Emir Teshem, we should continue many more. As we've heard and from Rabbi Reichman, Miki Amcha Yisrael, during a pandemic, the amount of volumes that have come out, just in terms of dealing with shilas from Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Schechter, Rav Silberstein, and as many of you know, also Rabbi Professor Steinberg put together a kuntres as well. And in his unique style, this kuntres follows an encyclopedic format. So rather than being individualized questions, it is comprehensive in that it takes all of the other, it surveys the literature and incorporates in an encyclopedia format the questions and the answers and the discussions that have been brought out by the other poskim in their respective kuntres. And it is available to the public on the Torah Motion website. So I'd encourage everybody to browse through it. To the conference individuals that have been here in the past, no introduction is necessary. However, it's really we owe a debt of gratitude, and it's my pleasure and my kavod really to introduce Rav Steinberg, who, as many of you know, is a senior pediatric neurologist at Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. He's the head of the editorial board of the Talmudic Encyclopedia and director of the Yad Harav Herzog Institute. He directs the medical ethics unit at Shaarei Tzedek. Many of us are familiar with Rav Steinberg through his written works. The Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, first in Hebrew, subsequently and then translated into English, and more recently, Refuah Kehalacha, which certainly is going to be the landmark publication in this field of Jewish medical ethics. As we all know, Rav Steinberg is the go-to individual when it comes to the interface of medicine and halacha. And we are honored that he has been a participant in our conference over the past 12 years. It's my great distinct pleasure to call upon Rav Steinberg, Revi Vemori. It's a pleasure to see you and hear from you again.
Thank you very much, Dr. Friedman, for your warm words. Indeed, it's the bat mitzvah year of this conference, and to the best of my knowledge, I think not only consecutively, but even the number of meetings has surpassed any other medical ethics halachic conference that I'm aware of. And so, a big yisher koach to Abel Kelman, to Dr. Friedman, to all those who help bring it up. It's really a pleasure to be every year together with you, with your families, and with all the regular participants and the coming participants. One advantage, I think, looking at the screen, 223 people now online, I think that is by itself an achievement which is not reached on the regular face-to-face conferences. But still, I like better to be engaged with people directly and not by these technologies, but what can we do? So hopefully the Bar Mitzvah conference will already be an open and communal stage. I would like to add my deep sadness of Dr. Turetsky's death. I was very, very sad to hear from his wife when she had childless around the end situation. I remember him very fondly as someone who was very interested, very interesting, always with a smile, and really a very special individual. And unfortunately, the coronavirus has taken such a precious life. And all these lectures that are dedicated in his memory should be Le'ilui Nishmato. One of the major issues in such pandemics are the issues that relate to triage decisions. It is not the, I have to disclose that I have no interests, and the learning objectives are to understand the rationale of halachic and ethical principles in medical triage and the implementation of triage-based care in a pandemic situation. So the issue of making such decisions is usually very tragic because it always involves, on the one hand, saving some or many, but on the other hand, indirectly causing the death of others, so that in normal circumstances, perhaps everyone could have been rescued. And that is always a very tragic decision. So the question is, how do we relate to it from a halachic point of view, and what are the sources that guide us from a halachic point of view? Interestingly, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in a letter written on a question that he was asked related to triage situations, obviously much before the corona one, but issues of this kind come up again and again. He writes to Professor Shimon Glick, who asked the question, "I can assure you that I am not setting firm guidelines regarding triage, since the questions are very severe and I don't know of clear precedents to rule on them." So if Shlomo Zalman didn't know clear proofs from sources, who are we to say it? But yet we have to face it, and we'll try to do the best to understand sources and implementations. So when we deal with triage issues, it's a whole host of measurements and equipment and personnel that can be short, can be scarce, and it creates the same question whether it's an ICU bed, a respirator, an ECMO machine, medications, vaccinations, protective gear, also personnel and testing materials. All these can be short, and some people will not be able to be saved because of that. How do you prioritize when you don't have enough supply? So there's a whole host of ways to do it. One is to say first come, first serve. No matter how sick or not sick the person is, the first one that I face as a physician, I take care of him. And if there's time and equipment for the next one, I'll take care of him. And if not, he will unfortunately die. It can be done randomly. I get a group of 20 people. All of them are in need of respirators. I have only 5 respirators. Whoever I choose randomly, I'll give the respirator to. It can be done by lottery. It can be done by social wealth. As we will see, halachically, there is some inclination to this. And it can be done by medical criteria, which is the most accepted way, both ethically, legally, and halachically, at least nowadays, and we'll explore it in a few minutes. So the issue of triage situations actually occurs many times, and some of the magnitude close or sometimes even greater in local areas than the corona one. There can be an aircraft accident, a train accident with many, many victims and very few people and measures to save all of them. We have witnessed a lot of floods and tsunamis and earthquakes with so many victims. Wars are always a situation where there's a medical officer and there are many soldiers wounded, and he has to decide who to take care of first, and obviously pandemics, which are not for the first time the corona. There were others, especially the Spanish flu 100 years ago. So what makes it a triage situation? These are sudden tragedies that were unanticipated, mass casualties of varying physical and emotional trauma in a very short time, and the resources are limited. So this combination really is a tragic combination, and we have to face it. What are the halachic considerations? So let me quote a few, I think, well-known passages in the Talmud that may have some relationship to our issue. The first one is the famous dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Ptora in Bava Metzia, where two people are walking on a desolate path, and there was a jug of water in the possession of one of them that if both drink, both will die, but if only one drinks, he'll reach the settled area and will be saved. Ben Petora says it's preferable that both of them drink and die, and let neither one of them see the death of the other. Until Rabbi Akiva came and taught that the verse, "and your brother shall live with you," indicates that your life takes precedence over the life of the other. So if there is enough water for one, and I am the owner of this particular amount of water, I am not to cut it into half so that both of us will die. Rather, I should drink the water and be saved, which obviously means that my fellow walker will die. This is, however, not relevant to modern situations, because here in the Gemara we talk about the owner of the life-saving equipment or measure, whereas we are talking about an owner who is the country, who is the public, and all in front of us are equally in need of it. And therefore, you can't say, "V'chay achicha imach," and your brother shall live with you, because you are not the one that is the victim, and the ones that are victims are equal brothers who shall live, and therefore we need to look for other sources. Another famous source is the Mishnah in Horayot that gives a social worth of priority. A priest precedes a Levite precedes an Israeli, and so on. And a Talmid Chacham, a Torah scholar, precedes everyone else, including a high priest. That is the Mishnah, the second Mishnah on this page in Horayot. The previous Mishnah states another priority, that a man comes before a woman to rescue or to return a lost object. Apparently, the Rambam did not understand that the first Mishnah, man and woman, relates actually to rescue, but only to returning a lost object, and therefore he does not state this priority in his Mishneh Torah. So he brings only the first paragraphs that we are dealing with. However, both Moshe Feinstein and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach independently used almost the same words, that it is very difficult or almost impossible to apply this hierarchy in modern days. First of all, there are practical questions. If you come and in front of you there are many people who are injured, you can't shout out who is a Kohen, and whoever raises his hand, you'll treat him first, because A, who says that he's really a Kohen, and B, you have to look into his yichus, whether he's really a Kohen or not. By that time, everyone else will die, including this Kohen. So that obviously is not something that can be done on a practical way. And the same holds true for the whole host of people listed here, and also for a Talmid Chacham. Who is defined as a Talmid Chacham? Can you test all those in front of you, whether they know this Mishnah and Oraios or not, and that's how you'll decide who is the Talmid Chacham? There are halachas, the Talmidei Chachomim don't apply with this type of law in our time, so therefore it is not applicable. And I think they had in mind also that it's not applicable in modern days to segregate people based on that priority. Incidentally, the Netziv in Meromei Sadeh, in his interpretation on Masechet Horayot, he explains that that has to do with the Kedusha. Kol ha-mekudash mechavero kodem lechavero, whoever is holier takes priority, and holiness goes according to the number of mitzvahs that one is obligated to fulfill. And since Kohanim have more mitzvahs than Yisraelim, and since men have more mitzvahs than women, that's why they take precedence. But again, this is almost by all halachic, current halachic sources, not applicable in our times. There are other sugyas that can be discussed when there are limited resources for the public, how to deal with pikuach nefesh situations. So there's another Mishnah in Gittin: captives are not redeemed for more than their monetary value for the betterment of the world. And the question is, the Gemara discusses, what is the betterment of the world not to exceed the monetary value to redeem a captive? According to most poskim, we are talking even in cases where the people who took this captive are threatening to kill him. So it's a real pikuach nefesh for this person. Yet, if they demand a ransom that is beyond their monetary value, which by itself is a question how to assess it, but assuming we know how to assess it, we are not going to pay it as a public in order to save this individual life. Why? Because of betterment of the world. So there are two explanations what a betterment of the world means. One explanation is that if the public will pay that much money, that will be an incentive to those who capture this one to capture many more, because they are making a lot of money. If they know that no matter what, they won't make that much money, so hopefully it will stop at this particular person. That obviously is irrelevant to our discussion. But the other explanation in the Gemara is that the reason that we are not redeeming a captive for more of their monetary value is because we as a society cannot become poor for one person. So that if we'll pay all that we have as a public, as a community, in order to redeem one person, the public will become poor, and that is enough of a reason not to go this direction. Now, in order for the public not to become poor means that many aspects that the public needs money takes precedence as a public over saving one person, and that includes not only pikuach nefesh issues, it includes education and social needs and even cultural needs and Talmud Torah and other expenses that the public at large needs, and therefore they should not pay that much money. Again, that is not directly relevant to our situation, because here we are not talking about causing the public to be poor or causing someone to create an epidemic or a pandemic, and therefore these considerations are only on the margin of our discussion. So therefore, we actually don't have a clear, direct source to discuss how do you prioritize, how do you triage a situation where as a society, the resources are limited. Without going into many other sugyas, which again, most of them are not relevant enough, the conclusion that the poskim have arrived are the following considerations. One is that the time of arrival seems to be important, so that if all come together, and if we go back to the Mishnah and Horaios, if everyone is together at the same time, and everyone is in need in order to get the measurements to save his life, and they are all in front of us, then the Mishnah in Horayot prioritize according to worlds, to worlds, to social worlds, and we'll see that we do it today a little differently. But what about if they come one after the other? So if one comes now and I have the means to save him, isn't it right to take care of him no matter what his condition is and no matter how much resource he will need to save his life, even though maybe later someone else will come and he won't have the resources to save his life? The answer to this is that indeed, if it's regular times and there are people who are coming one after the other, there is a rule of ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh. You're not allowed to delay the saving of one person in order to save someone else who might come later. But in a pandemic situation, even if people are arriving in different times, we know for sure that the reason that one is came a little earlier than others is just because maybe he had a quicker transportation, or maybe he felt right to come earlier to the hospital. But indeed, all of the people in need of the equipment and of the personnel to save their lives are somewhere all together. And that is similar to what the Chazon Ish expanded the definition of the Noida B'Yehuda concerning autopsies. It's not directly related the issue to us, but the definition is related. The Noida B'Yehuda allowed to perform an autopsy if there is a patient right in front of us, chole befaneinu, who we don't know how to treat him, and we assume that doing the autopsy to the one that passed away will give us tools to save his life. Says the Chazon Ish, in the days of the Noida B'Yehuda, that was really a requirement that the sick patient will be just in front of us in order to allow the autopsy of the one who died. But nowadays, with the widespread communication, the whole world is as if befaneinu. The whole world is as if there is another patient right here and there that if we can learn what the disease was and how to treat it, it will be implemented even if he's not physically in front of us. So the idea is that if we assume that there is a whole lot of people, even if they didn't come physically at the same time, we regard them as arriving at once. So how do we deal with practical aspects of triage decisions? So if we take this scenario, five patients who require an ICU bed or respirator, and there are only two available, who should receive the treatment to begin with? So the consideration is a medical consideration from modern halachic perspective, meaning we have to answer three questions. How severely ill is the patient? Because if he can sustain and improve without the ICU bed or without the respirator, then he takes less of priority, because at the moment we can still treat him without the means that are short. Also, how likely the medical interventions are to be beneficial. If we will give him this scarce resource, will it really help him to survive? Or despite the fact that we will treat him, he will either die or be respirator dependent forever, and we are losing the respirator for other people. And all this comes into account on how many people can be saved. And the rule is that we should try to save as many as possible so that we can use the equipment and the personnel in a way that we are treating the ones that are in need of this particular treatment, and that the short-term survival is a higher chance than others. Therefore, if there are patients who are in a worse medical condition than others, and their likelihood of benefit from medical intervention is better than others, they come before those with a less severe condition and those for whom their likelihood of recovery is lower. So on the one hand, all patients need to be saved, but since we can't save all of them, we should save those whose chance to survive is greater than others. There might be a situation where all are equal on a medical term. All are in need of this treatment, and all are roughly with the same chance either to survive or not to survive, but they're all equal. Who do we treat then? And here there is a machloikes between several poskim, the Chazon Ish, the Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yisraeli, Rav Herzog, and others, whether we go again by first come, first serve, or we go at random, or even we choose a lottery in order to give the chance from a more spiritual level to one that will be chosen to be treated. But although it may happen, and it does happen, in most cases there are differences between the medical conditions of the different people, and therefore the rules are still the same, that we treat the ones who are in need and the ones that have the greater chance to survive. Now, what are the halachic basis for these regulations, for these principles? So there are several such priority examples by the poskim. For instance, some of the poskim have ruled in past years that a healthy takes priority over the one who is dangerous. Obviously, healthy doesn't mean that he is totally healthy, because then he's not in need of the life-saving measures. Healthy means that when the intervention will be done, he will become healthy. In other words, he has good chances to survive. And the one in danger is someone who is so ill that even if he will get the treatment that is scarce, the likelihood of his recovery is lower. The same holds true for a person who is a treifa, who has a disease that is going to kill him, compared to a person who is not a treifa. So we prefer the not treifa to save his life, because the treifa will end up dying anyway, even if we treat him. And the third example is what we call in English terminology, terminal and not terminal. I said it several times. Terminal, I think, is a very bad misnomer, because we are all terminal. So it doesn't mean anything that we call someone terminal. He is maybe terminal in time, but we all terminal. So it's really what we call in Halacha Chayei Sha'a versus Chayei Olam, someone who is dying anyway because he has cancer, because he has an end-stage cardiac disease or other such medical conditions, and he is now sick with corona. If we give him the respirator, his chances to survive are very low anyway, so we would prioritize someone who doesn't have a terminal disease, who doesn't have a lethal disease, and he might be saved with the treatment. So these examples actually show us that we are going in this direction, that the medical condition is what counts if we can assess it correctly. Now, this is all triaging prior starting the treatment. So again, if a group of people come, we have limited resources, we didn't treat yet anyone, and we have to decide who should we give this limited scarce resource. These were the rules that I enumerated. But how about triaging after initiating the treatment? In other words, a group of people came, the physician in charge made his medical calculations, he decided that patient A is in need of the treatment and has a greater chance than others to survive, and therefore he admitted him to the ICU. He's not yet intubated, but then he deteriorates and he became a patient that his survival, his chances of survival became very low. Then the rule is that he should be moved out of the ICU into a regular department, but never to forget that he's still a patient, he's still alive, he needs to get his continuous, regular, and palliative care, but he cannot occupy an ICU bed anymore because his chances are low, and here is now another patient whose chances are greater, and therefore his ICU admission takes priority. What about such a patient that was admitted to the ICU and was intubated, and now he deteriorated, and now his chances to survive became very low, and there are other people who came whose chances to survive are much higher, but there is no more a respirator available. So halachically, we are not allowed to withdraw a respirator even from a patient who has no chances, because that is an act that enhances death, and by most poskim, although not by all, is regarded as killing the patient. And we are not allowed to kill one patient even in order to save another patient. As we said earlier, ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh. So what we can do is that we should not initiate new interventions to the patient whose chances are low, so that if he needs now blood pressure support or dialysis or other kinds of life-saving measures, we will not apply it. And although he is on a respirator, he will die sooner than if we would have treated him aggressively. And we also are allowed to move him to another department that, if they know how to take care of intubated, ventilated patients, but so we can free the ICU, although we are not yet freeing the respirator. And based on Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's PSAC, we are also allowed to limit the respiratory treatment, not only to limit adjacent treatments, but also to limit the respirator treatment so that we can reduce parameters of the respirator to a degree that the patient is still stable and not monitor him anymore, neither by the monitors of the respirator or by blood tests and so on. And once he deteriorates further and he's in need of increasing the support, we are not obligated to do so, and therefore he will pass away with the respirator without us doing an active act that hastens death, but yet not prolonging it beyond what is required, and that way we can treat other patients with the respirator or in the intensive care bed. So these are some of the ways that we can do it according to halacha, although we are not able to just disconnect the patient and free the respirator. Now, what about a risk-taking of either the healthcare providers or the patient himself? So as to the healthcare providers, although every person, not necessarily a professional, if he can save a life, there is a basic requirement of do not stand idly by your fellow man if you can save his life, but a layperson in the medical field is not obligated to risk his life even in a doubtful way in order to save someone else, even if he's in a certain danger. However, that is relatively not the approach for healthcare providers. They have an added moral obligation to take some risks in order to save people, so that if they are well protected and they do whatever is needed to protect themselves, even though there's still a small risk in doing it, they are still obligated to take care of patients who otherwise are in a certain danger and they will die unless they are taken care, and therefore they are allowed to take care and take some risk. Obviously, there are levels of risks that are discussed, but the basic risks are known. And for example, in the corona situation, healthcare teams, if they are well protected, the way we saw the picture of Dr. Reichman and many of his colleagues, the risk for them is very minimal, and the danger of the patient is certainly great, and therefore they should take this risk. Now, I want to, before concluding, let you know that we just finished in Israel to write a position paper on triage decisions for severely ill patients during this pandemic. This position paper was jointly commissioned by the Israeli National Bioethics Council, the Ethics Bureau of the Israel Medical Association, the Israeli Ministry of Health. And as you can see, it was just presented last week to the Ministry of Health and accepted as the official position of the State of Israel. It was established only a month and a half ago. We worked very hard to try and to finish it. At the beginning, we were afraid that Israel is going the direction of Italy, of Spain, and therefore it might be applicable. Baruch Hashem, it became a drosh vekabel sachar. It became just an exercise, an academic exercise, and hopefully we'll never need it. But A, there are countries who are in need of such an approach, and B, who knows what the future is bringing us, so that we should be prepared. As you can see, this was a multidisciplinary commission of 26 experts in various fields of medicine, ethics, law, sociology, social work, Jewish law, and we had even a Christian and a Muslim to participate in this commission. And as I chaired this commission, and as I did it previously in several complicated conditions, I divided the group into four major subcommittees: medical, philosophical, legal, and religious. You can imagine that we got almost four different position papers. We worked on it to combine it, and we concluded to have really a unanimously accepted a position paper by all the participants without any objections or minority opinion. There was a certain problem with the disabled community that didn't like certain recommendations. We worked on that as well. It subsided greatly. There are here and there still some who don't like certain parts of it. But as I said, the Minister of Health accepted it. And that is now the position of the Israeli government. And as you can see, it discusses at length the ethical, the legal, and the religious principles, how to deal with a scarcity of resources and triage decisions. And especially, we worked hard on the applied guidelines from a medical point of view, which criteria to use, how to build the flow sheet and the tables that will help a physician that is in the front line and has to make quick decisions who to prioritize. And that has been done very carefully so that the flowchart and the tables are on two pages. The physician obviously will not have time to read 20 pages in order to decide how to triage, but in preparation for it, he can learn what the principles are and how they are changing in a triage decision. So in summary, I think that the extraordinary events of the coronavirus pandemic obligates humankind and mankind, and particularly those of us in the religiously observant community, to engage in serious introspection. We scientists thought that after the 1918 pandemic of the Spanish flu, we conquered the virus world and nothing of this kind will ever happen again. And here, time and again, we are proved wrong with all our science, with all our ability to get to the moon and perhaps to the Mars, and yet we can't fight even a little virus that creates such a tumult all over the world. So some ways of humble and introspection of the scientific community is in place. But I think that more so, should we think about our own people, we saw, unfortunately, a much higher proportion of mortality and of death and sickness in Haredi communities, both in Israel and around the world. There are many explanations why it happened so, but I think these are all justifications. What we need to look into ourselves is to look why it happened in this way. And incidentally, I think perhaps once in the Jewish history, there was such a situation where no shul, no yeshiva, no Talmud Torah was open throughout the world. Even during World War II, which was a terrible time, and so many perished, and yeshivas were closed, and shuls were closed, but there were parts in the world where they were still open. If it was in Europe, so in Israel, they were still open. In the United States, in Australia, there were areas where Jewish life continued in a classic way. This time, all over the world, it was all closed. And it is as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us something was wrong with your behavior that I didn't like, your shuls, your yeshivas, your way of learning, your way of davening, something seems to be wrong. So it is an obligation to collectively and individually look into ourselves, for there is no man so holy, righteous on earth that he always does good and never sins. So when Shlomo HaMelech says it, he talks about man, which is every man, from the greatest to the lowest. Everyone, according to his own grade, has to do tshuva, has to look into what happened that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did this tragic event to the entire world and to the entire Jewish community. So hopefully, tshuva, tefillah, utzdakah will help us to overcome this pandemic and bring us to become better people, better Jews, and better individuals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Professor Steinberg. As always, a tremendous honor to hear you and learn from you. There are some questions that have been posted, and with all due respect to all of the questions, what we are going to do is, I don't think we'll be able to reach all of them. There are many that are coming up. Some of them are complex in nature. Rabbi Jay and I have been sort of pooling them together to try to be able to deliver them in a rapid fashion. And we will present them to Rabbi Steinberg and try to get through as many questions as possible and trying to keep as well on time. Rabbi Steinberg, can you address the issue of age in the triage, both with respect to children versus adults? And elderly, what age, at the age issue at all?
Right. So there's only one poisek, the Yavetz, who holds that a young takes precedence over the old. All poskim disagreed with him, including the major poskim of our generation. Again, Moshe Feinstein from Zalman Auerbach very specifically wrote that age per se is not an element to take into account in triaging, meaning that if a 70-year-old person comes together with a 20-year-old person, both have the same medical condition, there is no advantage of the 20-year-old over the 70-year-old. The reason is that every life counts as a whole world. If you save one life, and it doesn't say if it's young or old, it is as if you saved the whole world. Every year of life is as important as many years. And incidentally, even though statistically the 20-year-old one has a chance to live many more years, he may get killed in a car accident the next day, whereas the 70-year-old can live another 20 years, and he obviously can surpass him. So it's not always according to age. And more importantly, how do you distinguish the age? If it is 20 and 70, maybe someone can say that he sees a difference. But what about 30 and 50? What about 40 and 50? Obviously, there are no limits that you can set to say that one age is more important than the other age. And as I said, basically, not even calculating all these side calculations, the number of years are not counted. And indeed, in our position paper, we made it very specific that the medical criteria are accounted for only for the short-term survival of the particular disease and treatment, not the long-term prognosis of how many years are left for each individual to live. That is not in our hands, and therefore that is not accounted as a triage consideration.
Thank you. Rabbi Steinberg, on the issue of autopsy, specifically regarding a COVID patient, would that qualify as a chole lefaneinu of the Noda B'Yehuda?
Say it again?
Regarding an autopsy for COVID patients. Recognizing that we're in a pandemic and we have technically chole lefaneinu, a new disease which we don't know anything about, can you comment on autopsy?
Well, if the autopsy would have been helpful without resulting to other means, that would probably account for becoming a chole lefaneinu because the whole world is now lefaneinu. However, I don't see any medical advantage in performing a full autopsy on a corona died patient, a person, because nothing in an open biopsy can teach us other than taking a sample, a biopsy or a fluid and test the virus and test the areas that he afflicted. There are now reports not only of the pneumonia, but also of the cardiac involvement and kidney involvement. But all these can be studied either by imaging, which is as accurate as open autopsy in many cases, and certainly by biopsies. All are permissible halachically, and therefore there's no reason to do an open autopsy. Also, the infectability in dealing with a corpse of a coronavirus victim is quite great, and I don't know any pathologists who would like to do it.
Steinberg, you mentioned in some of your slides that the idea of treating some of these individuals not as intensively or aggressively as normal in terms of ventilatory support, blood pressure support, dialysis, and so on and so forth. These reductions, is this only specific to corona, or is this something in the same situation that would be applicable outside of the corona? In other words, those treatments that that we are withdrawing. Based on another question that I see here, the question is in reverse. How are we permitted for the ICU patient on a respirator not to provide full support?
Well, so actually it was invented, quote unquote, for regular circumstances, not for a pandemic, or certainly not now for the corona. It was decided to do this for a dying patient who is suffering tremendously, and palliative care is either unavailable or not helpful enough, and a patient, either we know that he didn't want to suffer that much, or the family assumes that he would not have wanted to suffer that much. In this case, the reduction, the limiting of the treatment is not within the parameters of Ritzicha, as opposed to withdrawing the respirator. It is within the parameter of Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa. In other words, if you can save someone, you are obligated to save. But this is not applicable to a dying patient, where a priori we are allowed not to prolong his life if this is his wish, or if he is suffering terribly. We know it from the story of Rabbi Yehuda Anosi. We know it from the Psak of the Remor, that we are allowed to withhold treatments that prolong life so that the patient will die sooner if he is a dying patient, a Chayeshah, which has its own definition. And therefore, by not supplying these measures, by withholding these measures from a dying corona patient, it is similar to any a terminal condition of many situations where the patient, where we exhausted all that we know how to cure the patient. Now all is left is to prolong his dying process and to add suffering, which we are, according to Moshe Feinstein, not even allowed to do, but certainly according to other poskim, we are not obligated to do. And therefore, that is perfectly within the halachic parameters of most poskim.
Rabbi Steinberg, I'm going to ask you a question about defining the chance of survival. You spoke during your discussion about low chance of survival. Is that something quantitative?
Yes. So we, in this position paper, adopted a four medical criteria, which help us to assess with certain accuracy. Obviously, we know that prognosis is a field that is not the best in medicine, but from experience, we know it. One is the performance score. The other one is the adjacent, the comorbidities. The third one is how many other organs are affected besides the pneumonia. And the fourth one is the general assessment of an experienced physician. So that if we have a patient who is bedridden for already weeks or months prior to becoming a corona pneumonia patient, or a patient who, and or a patient who has a severe heart disease or kidney disease, and he has involvement now not only as a pneumonia, but also from a kidney failure, the general assessment is in such situation that he has less than 20% chance to survive. Whereas a healthy person with no comorbidities, who is active up to becoming sick, and the general assessment is that he has only pneumonia, and this pneumonia requires a respirator, he has over 80% a chance to survive. And these tables are available, and that is the tools that a physician can use when he has to decide how to treat the patients.
Thank you. A question from Rafael Guggenheim. Is there not a possibility of respirator therapy on time switch, on some sort of a switch? I know in Israel there's been discussion about the timer, and is that something that is available, implementable? If you can comment on that.
Right. So according to most poskim, if this would have been available, and if it would have been set up a priori, meaning that by the time we resuscitate a patient, we put him on a ventilator, already the timer works, then according to most poskim, it is similar to the Shabbos timer that we use every week, that we are not allowed to put on or put off light, but if we, prior to the time that we need the light and it is still permissible to use light, we put the timer and that operates at the time where we are not allowed to do, that is allowed. And therefore, in principle, that is something that most poskim agree. In practice, for many reasons, I don't have the time to go into, we were not successful to design an exterior timer that would work safely on existing respirators. In this particular pandemic, since there was a fear in Israel that there will not be enough respirators, besides purchasing from many countries in the world, including Arab countries and many others that the Mossad was able to bring, several companies in Israel are now producing respirators. And therefore, I turned to the Ministry of Health and said that this is the right timing to interest these companies to build the respirator with a built-in timer a priori, so that it will be another chip in the respirator that can be operated. And indeed, we are now in contact with several Israeli companies, and hopefully, as I understand, they think it's feasible technologically, and the question will only be regulatory, and we are working on it now, and hopefully, out of this corona pandemic, a respirator with a timer might emerge.
Rabbi Jay, do we stop now? You might want to unmute yourself.
Yeah, as much as we'd like to go on, I think we want to keep as close to our schedule as possible. We're already at 10:59, so we'll take a 5-minute break. Everybody, want to thank you. Laser will thank you. Formerly, Dr. Steinberg, always a pleasure, and really the tremendous work and everything you do in the field, and your warmth and accessibility is really a pleasure. All who come every year know how warm, and that's why you come every year. And it's really wonderful. And thank you very much. And we should all be healthy and well. And we'll come back in 5 minutes. Dr. Glad, who's been so involved in the field. This is his specialty, infectious disease. So I know Dr. Glad is on, and really we'll welcome you officially. So we'll take a few minute break, get a cup of coffee, a muffin, whatever you'd like. And thank you.
Laser. Thank you, Rabbi
Thank you
Steinberg.
Very much.
A pleasure. And the there were some questions about if the resources that about the position paper is available. We can post it. Is it available online, or is it something that you can send to me? We can put it on. Would that be available?
Yes, I can send it to you, and you can distribute it. And it's also available on the official website of the Ministry of Health. But since going into ministerial website is always a big task, so I think it will be easier if I send it to you.
And we'll post it like everything else on the term.